The faces of the two pilots were white as bone as they turned to watch the interceptor. The woman leaned over the back of the left-hand seat and lifted the clumsy black weapon in an ironic salute. She smiled, and the Mirage pilot was close enough to see how white her teeth were. "A young woman, blonde hair, moi, baya moi," the Mirage pilot reported. "Pretty, very pretty." "Diamond One, this is Cheetah. Position for head-on attack." The Mirage thundered instantly ahead and climbed away swiftly, the other four aircraft of the flight sweeping in to resume their tight finger-five formation as they went out in a wide turn ahead of the Boeing. "Cheetah, we're in a position for a head-on attack." "Diamond flight, simulate. Attack in line astern. 5-second intervals. Minimum separation. Do not, I say again, do not open fire. This is a simulated attack. I say again, this is a simulated attack. Diamond One understands simulated attack." And the Mirage F1 winged over and dived, its speed rocketing around the Mach scale, booming through the sonic barrier in a fearsomely aggressive display. Cyril Watkins saw him coming from 7 miles ahead. "Jesus," he shouted, "this is real!" And he lunged forward to take manual control of the Boeing, to pull her off the automatic approach that the electronic flight director was performing. "Hold her steady!" Ingrid raised her voice for the first time. "Hold it!" She swung the gaping double muzzles of the shot pistol onto the flight engineer. "We don't need a navigator now." The captain froze, and the Mirage howled down on them, seemed to grow until it filled the whole view through the windshield ahead. At the last possible instant of time, the nose lifted slightly, and it flashed only feet overhead. But the supersonic turbulence of its passage struck and tossed even that huge machine like a piece of thistledown. "Here comes another!" Cyril Watkins shouted. "I mean it." Ingrid pressed the muzzles so fiercely into the back of the flight engineer's neck that his forehead struck the edge of the computer console, and there was the quick, bright rose of blood on the pale skin. The jet blast struck the Boeing one after the other as the Mirages attacked. Ingrid clutched wildly for support with her free hand, but kept the pistol jammed into the navigator's neck. "I mean it," she kept shouting, "I'll kill him." And they could hear the screams of the passengers even through the bulkhead of the flight deck. Then the last Mirage was past and gone, and the Boeing's flight director recovered from the battering of close separation and quickly realigned the aircraft onto the radio navigational beacons of Jan Smuts Airport. "They won't buzz us again." Ingrid stepped back from the flight engineer, allowing him to lift his head and wipe away the trickle of blood on the sleeve of his shirt. "They can't come again. We're in controlled airspace." She pointed ahead. "Look." The Boeing was down to 5,000 feet, but the horizon was obscured by the haze of smog and summer heat. To the right rose the smooth silhouette of the Kempton Park power station cooling towers, and closer at hand, the poisonous yellow tablelands of the mine dumps squatted on the flat and featureless plain of the African Highveld. Around them, human habitation was so dense that hundreds of window panes caught the early morning sun and glittered like beacons. Closer still was the long, straight, blue streak of the main runway of Jan Smuts Airport. "Take her straight in on runway 21, Ingrid ordered. "We can't." "Do it," snapped the girl. "Air traffic control will have cleared the circuit. They can't stop us." "Yes, they can," Cyril Watkins answered. "Just take a look at the runway apron." They were close enough now to count 5 fuel tenders, to see the Shell Company insignia on the tanks. "They're going to block the runway." With the tankers were 5 brilliant red vehicles of the fire service and 2 big white ambulances. They bumped wildly over the grass verge of the runway, and then, one after the other, tenders and fire control vehicles and ambulances parked at intervals of a few hundred yards down the white-painted centre line of the runway. "We can't land," said the captain. "Take her off automatic and fly her in by hand." The girl's voice was different, hard, cruel. The Boeing was sinking through 1,000 feet, lined up for runway 21, and directly ahead, the revolving red beacons on top of the fire vehicles seemed to flash a direct challenge. "I can't pile into them," Cyril Watkins decided, and there was no longer hesitation nor doubt in his tone. "I'm going to overshoot and get out of here." "Land on the grass," the girl shrieked. "There's open grass on the left of the runway. Put her down there." But Cyril Watkins had leaned forward in his seat and rammed the bank of throttles forward. The engines howled, and the Boeing surged into a nose-high climb. The young flight engineer had swiveled his stool and was staring ahead through the windscreen. His whole body was rigid, his expression intense, and the smear of blood across his forehead was in vivid contrast to the pallor of his skin. With his right hand he gripped the edge of his desk, and the knuckles of his fist were white and shiny as eggshell. Without seeming to move, the blonde girl had pinned the wrist of that rigid right hand, pressing the muzzles of the pistol into it. There was a crash of sound, so violent in the confines of the cabin that it seemed to beat in their eardrums. The weapon kicked up as high as the girl's golden head, and there was the immediate, acrid stench of burned cordite. The flight engineer stared down incredulously at the desktop. There was a hole blown through the metal as big as a teacup, and the edges were jagged with bright, bare metal. The blast of shot had amputated his hand cleanly at the wrist. The severed member had been thrown forward into the space between the pilot's seats, with the shattered bone protruding from the mangled meat. It twitched like a crushed and maimed insect. "Land," said the girl. "Land, or the next shot is through his head." "You bloody monster!" shouted Cyril Watkins, staring at the severed hand. "Land, or you will be responsible for this man's life." The flight engineer clutched the stump of his arm against his belly and doubled over it silently, his face contorted by the shock. Cyril Watkins tore his stricken gaze from the severed hand and looked ahead once more. There was wide open grass between the runway markers and the narrow taxiway. The grass had been mown knee-high, and he knew the ground beneath it would be fairly smooth. Cyril's hand on the throttle bank pulled back smoothly, almost of its own volition. The engine thunder died away, and the nose dropped again. He held his approach aligned with the main runway until he was well in over the threshold lights. He didn't want to alert the drivers of the blocking vehicles to his intention while they still had time to counter it. "You murderous bitch," he said under his breath. "You filthy, murderous bitch." He banked the Boeing steeply, realigned it with the long strip of open grass, and cut the throttles completely, bringing her in nose high and just a fraction above the stall, flaring out deliberately low and banging the Boeing down into the grass for positive touchdown. The huge machine settled to the rough strip, jolting and lurching wildly as Cyril Watkins fought the rudders to keep them lined up, holding his nose wheel off with the control yoke, while his co-pilot threw all her giant engines into reverse thrust and trod firmly down on the main landing gear brakes. The fire engines and fuel tankers flashed past the starboard wingtip. The startled faces of their crews seemed very close and white. Then 070 was passed, her speed bleeding off sharply, so her nose wheel dropped, and she rocked and swayed gradually to a dead stop, just short of the brick building which housed the approach and landing beacons and the main radar installations. It was 7:25 a.m. local time, and Speedbird 070 was down. "Well, they are down," intoned Kingston Parker, "and you can well understand the extreme efforts that were made to prevent them. Their choice of final destination settles one of your queries, Peter." "A la Lamond," Peter nodded. "It's got to be political. I agree, sir." "And you and I must now face in dreadful reality what we have discussed only in lofty theory." Parker held a taper to his pipe and puffed twice before going on. "Morally justifiable militancy." "Again, we have to differ, sir," Peter cut in swiftly. "There is no such thing."
"Is there not?" Parker asked, shaking his head. "What of the German officers killed in the streets of Paris
by the French resistance. That was war, Peter exclaimed. Perhaps the group that seized 070 believes that they are at war. With innocent victims, Peter shot back. The Haganah took innocent victims, yet what they were fighting for was right and just. I'm an Englishman, Dr. Parker. You cannot expect me to condone the murder of British women and children. Peter had stiffened in his chair. No, Parker agreed, so let us not speak of the Mau Mau in Kenya, nor of present-day Ireland, then. But what of the French Revolution, or the spreading of the Catholic faith by the most terrible persecution and tortures yet devised by man? Were those not morally justifiable militancy? I would prefer to call it understandable, but reprehensible. Terrorism in any form can never be morally justifiable. Provoked himself, Peter used the word deliberately, to provoke, and saw the small lift of Parker's thick, bushy eyebrows. There is terrorism from above as well as from below. Parker picked up the word and used it deliberately. If you define terrorism as extreme physical or physiological coercion, used to induce others to submit to the will of the terrorist, there is the legal terror threat of the gallows, the religious terror threat of hellfire, the paternal terror threat of the cane. Are those more morally justifiable than the aspiration of the weak, the poor, the politically oppressed, the powerless victims of an unjust society? Is their scream of protest to be strangled? Peter shifted uncomfortably in his chair. Protest outside the law. Laws are made by man, almost always by the rich and the powerful. Laws are changed by men, usually only after militant action. The women's suffragette movement, the civil rights campaign in this country. Parker broke off and chuckled. I'm sorry, Peter. Sometimes I confuse myself. It's often more difficult to be a liberal than it is to be a tyrant. At least the tyrant seldom has doubts. Parker lay back in his chair, a dismissive gesture. I propose to leave you in peace for an hour or two now. You will want to develop your plans in line with the new developments. But I personally have no doubts now that we are dealing with politically motivated militants and not merely a gang of old-fashioned kidnappers after a fast buck. Of one other thing I am certain. Before we see this one through, we will be forced to examine our own consciences very closely. Take the second right, said Ingrid quietly, and the Boeing swung off the grass onto the taxiway. There seemed to be no damage to her landing gear, but now that she had left her natural element, the aircraft had lost grace and beauty and became lumbering and ungainly. The girl had never been on the flight deck of a grounded jumbo before, and the height was impressive. It gave her a feeling of detachment, of being invulnerable. Now left again, she instructed, and the Boeing turned away from the main airport building towards the southern end of the runway. The observation deck of the airport's flat roof was already lined with hundreds of curious spectators, but all activity on the apron was suspended. The waiting machines and tenders were deserted, not a single human figure on the tarmac. Park there. She pointed ahead to an open area 400 yards from the nearest building, midway between the terminal and the cluster of service hangars and the main fuel depot. Stop on the intersection. Grimly silent, Cyril Watkins did as he was ordered, and then turned in his seat. I must call an ambulance to get him off. The co-pilot and a stewardess had the flight engineer stretched out on the galley floor, just beyond the door to the flight deck. They were using linen table napkins to bind up the arm and try and staunch the bleeding. The stench of cordite still lingered and mingled with the taint of fresh blood. Nobody leaves this aircraft. The girl shook her head. He knows too much about us already. My God, woman, he needs medical attention. There are 300 doctors aboard, she pointed out indifferently. The best in the world. Two of them may come forward and attend to him. She perched sideways on the flight engineer's blood-splattered desk and thumbed the internal microphone. Cyril Watkins noticed, even in his outrage, that it needed only a single demonstration and Ingrid was able to work the complicated communications equipment. She was bright and very well trained.